I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. 2014 is shaping up as a year of seismic change for college athletics, and the University of Maryland is part of it, bidding farewell to the Atlantic Coast Conference and entering the Big Ten in a quest for prestige and big money. In today's second hour, a look at Maryland's move to the Big Ten with Sports at Large commentator Milton Kent. Here in the first hour, Towson University professor Howard Nixon, a sociologist who studies sports, talks about what he calls the athletic trap, the endless efforts by college presidents to squeeze gold out of football and basketball while eliminating non-revenue sports to make their budgets. Big colleges, big money, Maryland and the Big Ten, after the news. Good afternoon, everyone. Dan Rodericks here, welcoming you to Midday and our look at college athletics. This is a big year for the NCAA, and I do not mean what's happening on the fields, but off the fields. Players have won rulings giving them the right to organize unions and benefit from the sale of their images. Meanwhile, the NCAA is cutting the richest conferences loose from rules regulating scholarships, payments, and other inducements for its so-called scholar athletes. In the second hour of the show today, WYPR sports commentator Milton Kent leads a discussion about another big story in college sports this year, the University of Maryland's decision to leave the Atlantic Coast Conference for the Big Ten. And speaking of Maryland and the Terrapins, consider this. The University of Maryland College Park pays its football and basketball coaches about $2 million a year each. That's four times as much as the president makes, but less than a third of what some big-time colleges pay their coaches. Even with a beautiful stadium and fieldhouse, ticket revenues, TV royalties, private contributions, and a much-hated mandatory fee of $403 from each of College Park's 27,000 undergraduates, the school's athletic program got so deep in the hole that it was forced to eliminate eight lower-profile teams like tennis, swimming, and track. The athletic deficit is one reason why Maryland ditched its old buddies in the ACC and moved to the Big Ten. Revenue sharing there will bring millions, but it won't bring swimming or tennis back. Fans will also have to get used to seeing Wisconsin, Illinois, and Iowa as rivals instead of Virginia, Duke, and North Carolina. None of this surprises our guest in this hour of Midday, Howard Nixon, a sociologist who studies sports, says the same dilemma confronts many colleges trying to emulate huge money machines, such as the University of Texas, whose football team in 2012 generated $109 million in revenue, and get this, $81 million in profits. Unfortunately, Howard Nixon says only a few teams have that kind of success. Too many others are described in his book, The Athletic Trap, How College Sports Corrupted the Academy. Howard Nixon sees a golden triangle out there, a powerful social network of athletic, media, and commercial interests who lure college presidents and trustees into an athletic arms race. They promise greater visibility, enhanced prestige, improved academic programs, higher enrollments, better students, and more loyal alums who contribute even more money. But more often than not, high-profile Division I athletic programs turn into money pits. Too many schools, Howard Nixon says, spend more than they can afford on lavish stadiums, field houses, and other facilities. They admit too many marginal student-athletes, too, who need expensive tutoring and hand-holding to reach even high school academic levels. And while big-time wannabes turn coaches into millionaires, they starve academic programs and share mere crumbs with the athletes who generate the sports dollars. Those athletes are finally fighting for their piece of the pie. They've won preliminary battles in courts for the right to unionize and get paid for the use of their images in video games and other promotional materials. Meanwhile, to keep itself from imploding, the NCAA proposes to let the five richest conferences treat their athletes better than everyone else. Critics call that an athletic caste system. We'll talk about it in this hour of the show with Howard Nixon. Howard Nixon is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Towson University, who spent his career studying sports and society. His book is, again, The Athletic Trap, How College Sports Corrupted the Academy. It's published by the Johns Hopkins University Press, and we welcome Howard Nixon to our show today. Howard, nice to have you on the show, sir.
Thank you, Dan. Thanks for inviting me.
How did you decide to become a sports sociologist? When did all that happen? I'm just curious.
Well, it happened quite by accident. Actually, I wasn't trained at all. I was trained as a mathematical sociologist and a political sociologist, and there was not much of a field of sports sociology at the time back in the early 1970s, and I saw a book come across my desk. It was a reader. It was the readings weren't very sophisticated from a sociological standpoint, but I thought, gee, that looks interesting. And I talked to my chair about getting involved in it, and I thought, you know, gee, I've been really risking my reputation. And I thought, no, I don't have any reputation to risk. So, and he was very supportive. He just said, do good sociology. So it's been a nice run.
And as time went on, you became more and more focused on this question about college sports itself and what that's done to the original mission of all these universities.
Right, because I've also had an interest in higher education. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, this book is as much about higher education as it is about sports in some ways. It's, you know, it's about the corruption of higher education by commercial sports. And, you know, it's not a new story. It started back in the 19th century, and there's a story about the president, Eliot of Harvard, who was president there for 40 years, and over his tenure, he saw college football grow, and of course, the big-time teams at that time were the Harvards and the Yales, and he kept going to his trustees and saying, you know, we've got to get rid of this football. It was very dangerous. People were dying on the field. There were tramp athletes who weren't really students, and they kept turning him down. So, you know, it has origins that go back a long way. And, you know, the thing about people who are reform-minded, as I am, some will say we need to get rid of big-time college sports. And I think, you know, I have to be realistic. Most of the big public universities have big-time teams. It's been around for, you know, college sports. Big-time college sports has been around for a long time.
Big budgets, big revenue
Absolutely.
Generation.
Absolutely. So the question is, you know, how do we make it more responsive to athletes and students and tie it more closely to the academic mission of universities.
What do you think about the trend toward breaking the charade that this is an amateur sport? This idea of, well, if not unionization, certainly compensating the players, just paying them outright to entertain crowds of people and to get those TV ratings.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that pay for play is an interesting argument, and people argue about how much, how would we do it. I really think it's the wrong question. My question, really, the central question I ask is, how do you change the underlying structure of sport to, you know, eliminate the corruption, the hypocrisy that currently exists? I mean, this people keep saying, you know, we've now eliminated the collegiate model. Well, you know, that's the rhetoric that the NCAA has used for a long time to talk about college sports. You know, as basically amateurs playing at it and getting an education while they're doing it. But, you know, it for the vast majority of young people who play college sports, they are truly amateurs, you know. And so, you know, and that's not going away. At least I hope not. We're talking about a small segment, but it gets a disproportionate amount of the resources and the attention.
The title of your book is interesting, The Athletic Trap. What is that trap you're describing? And please tell us what the life of a college president is like, a big college president is like, in terms of all this.
Yeah, let me give you an example, a fairly recent example of Holden Thorpe. He was the chancellor, which is the name for the president, at the University of North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And you probably know, a lot of the listeners probably know, that North Carolina has been under criticism and, you know, for a few years now because of an academic cheating scandal. It involved bogus grades and, in fact, led to the elimination of the departure of the former chair of the African and African American Studies department. There are all kinds of charges and countercharges about cheating. Well, Holden Thorpe was this guy who had come up through the ranks at the University of North Carolina. He loved the institution, and he finally got the chance to lead it. And after a few years of dealing with the various kinds of challenges that college presidents deal with, but especially the problems in athletics, he finally gave up. And he essentially said, look, I mean, I just, there's nothing I can do about this. It's a travesty. And so he went and became, he resigned and became the provost at Washington University in St. Louis, which is not likely to cause the same problems for him.
So what was the trap for him?
The trap
is... Describe his trap and the trap of other
presidents.
Yeah,
the trap is this. You know, once institutions and presidents decide that they want to make an investment in college sports and in commercialized college sports, they start making deals with TV through their conferences. They start in making deals with licensing companies. They make promises to their alumni. They build big facilities and ever bigger facilities. They get caught up in an arms race. And the arms race, of course, is that, you know, the escalating spending that has no end because you always want to get ahead of your competitor. Well, you know, here's the trap for presidents. You know, once they've bought into that, it's really hard to go back off from it. They've made these promises. They've tied the branding of the university to their athletic program. So where are they going to go? And alumni and boosters in particular get very, very upset when presidents back off. And very few have. I mean, they get caught up in the hoopla and the excitement themselves. But at the same time, they realize they have obligations and very, you know, powerful people want their athletic programs to succeed. So the trap is essentially getting caught up in these obligations, commitments, investments, promises, and having no place to turn, or at least no perceived. Now, I have to emphasize that, no perceived place to turn. They could do something as radical as Robert Maynard Hudgens at Chicago in 1939. He just said, we're not going to do this anymore. And he was talking about a team, the teams of Amos Alonzo Stagg, you know, All-Americans, one of the biggest of the big-time football schools in America. And he said, enough of this.
Now, why did he say enough of this? Because it was counter to the mission of the university?
Absolutely. He was much more concerned, as you would think a college president would be, with the academic reputation of the institution. He did what I think Charles Eliot at Harvard might have wanted to do, but couldn't, you know. You know, there are very few cases like this. You hear them once in a while.
Of a president standing down, saying no more.
Exactly. And right. And it's difficult. I mean, because remember, presidents, especially modern presidents, spend a lot of their time trying to cultivate donors, improve the brand of the university. And so
and the donors like to go to football and basketball games.
Absolutely. Yeah. They like to sit in those special boxes and get special treatment, and they love their sports. And, you know, this is an important thing to realize, too. While surely there are many college students who enjoy watching college sports teams, including the ones at their own school. Most of the people who are big-time college sports fans really don't care much about what happens at the university except what's on the athletic field. And so, you know, you're not going to get a tremendous amount of sympathy for the kinds of arguments that reform-minded people might have.
How many University of Maryland basketball fans in the Gary Williams days, for instance, knew what the graduation rate was for players at Gary Williams?
Which was zero 1 year. Yeah.
Zero 1 year. Yeah. Howard Nixon is our guest, a sports sociologist, a professor emeritus of sociology now at Towson University. His book is The Athletic Trap, How College Sports Corrupted the Academy. You can join our conversation with observations or questions for Howard Nixon. When we get back, we'll talk some more about all this. 410-662-8780 is the phone number for Midday. We're devoting both hours of our show today to a look at college athletics, college sports. There's a lot going on in this world, including in the second hour of our show, a talk about what the University of Maryland's doing, moving into the Big Ten Conference. 410-662-8780, the Midday email address. Midday@wypr.org. And welcome back to Midday. Talking with Howard Nixon, sports sociologist at Towson University, professor emeritus there now, author of this very timely book, The Athletic Trap, How College Sports Corrupted the Academy. Johns Hopkins University Press is the publisher of this book. And in it, Howard Nixon argues that on too many campuses, college presidents and trustees have lost control to forces that want to build powerful football and basketball programs, but wind up decimating less visible sports, the low money, no revenue sports of, say, baseball, swimming, track, tennis, wrestling that disappeared on many college campuses, not to mention the diversion of funds that could be used for the school's primary academic mission. Before, in our first segment, Howard, you mentioned the University of North Carolina.
Right.
Christian Science Monitor had an excellent piece back in May or June on college sports and found that 60% of the football and basketball players at UNC from 2004 to 2012, they studied an 8-year or 9-year period there, 60% of those players read at the 4th to 8th grade level, and 8 to 10% read at the 3rd grade level. And now we have the NCAA telling some conferences that they can just go about their business here in terms of those standards and other standards.
Well, this is not a new story, of course.
No, it's not.
And it's very sad. I mean, this is really why I think that what's needed is a very serious effort at reform that gets at the basic structure of college sports. And I have a reform chapter in the book on that fundamentally focuses on the partitioning of college sports. And, you know, it's, some of that's happening already for those who think this is unrealistic. I mean, essentially, I'm saying separate out what are essentially the, what are now the Big Five. They remember they were not too long ago the Elite Six.
Mm-hmm. Can you list them for us? Texas is one.
That's right. Well, there are 64 to 65 of them, depending on how you count.
Those.
They're the big, yeah, the ACC,
the big conferences.
Absolutely,
you mean.
Yes, okay. Right. Yes, and you know, I said, you know, let them cut them off. Let them move in the direction they're currently moving, which is toward autonomy. Let them also on campuses, let the athletic programs be, you know, for the big time ones. Now, mainly right now, the ones that can afford it will be football and men's basketball. I mean, there is a gender issue here, but, you know, we can deal with that later.
So if you partition them off, you say, okay, the big
right.
conferences, you're going to do your thing.
And they become semi-autonomous.
Right. What happens to the Towsons or the UMBCs?
All the rest of them, and this is a hard pill to swallow, all the rest of them become part of what I call the new NCAA, a truly amateur realm, much less commercialized, much more oriented to the welfare of student-athletes, which is, in fact, what the rhetoric of the NCAA is all about, isn't it? I mean, the school, you just cannot pay the cost of competing in big-time college sports unless you're in, you know, one of those big conferences. And really, only 20 to 23 of all the schools that compete in college sports break even from their athletic revenue.
I don't want to assume that our listeners understand why these programs cost so much. I guess you can look at a college football game and see, what, 50, 60 players on the sideline and assume that looks like a lot of money.
That's not where all the money's
going.
Let's
not assume everybody understands why it's so expensive.
Well, part of it, of course, is the fact that you have, you know, you lead with the top paid coaches. Alabama, Nick Saban just signed a $7 million a year contract. And then forget, that does not cover all of his staff, his many, many staff members, who total in the millions, the maintenance of big stadiums. We don't even count this, you know, the capital costs and the debt that's incurred by universities. You have athletic scholarships. You have travel. I mean, it's amazing how it adds up into the many millions. And I think that, and we think, well, basketball's only got a few players, but when you pay a coach like Mike Krzyzewski or many, many others in the millions of dollars, and he makes over $7 million a year himself, then, you know, the costs add up.
And you're saying there are only certain schools that can do that, can pull all that off.
Well, who can make enough revenue to cover those costs strictly out of their athletic ventures.
Okay.
Now, so the question is, you know, how do all these schools do it then? How do the Towsons,
let's just talk about Towson as an example.
Okay.
What would happen there under your idea?
Okay, what would happen is, first of all, you know, it has a $20 million budget, but 80 to 85% comes from student fees, mandatory student fees.
Yeah, by the way, the student fee at Towson, am I right, is like $800 a year?
Yeah, and you know, it used to be, I was on the athletic committee there.
We should explain to listeners who don't know this, on top of your tuition and room and
absolutely.
Board and all,
yeah.
There is this fee for all students to support the athletic program at $800-some a year.
Yes, that's right. Right. And, it used to be buried, and then the USA Today said, you know, let's get honest about how we're, you know, about these fees. And so it's now public knowledge. But the at Towson, you know, how would this work? Okay. What would it look like in the future? I mean, I think that it would look a lot different than a lot of the biggest boosters want it to look like. But essentially, you would have the athletic department eliminated. All of the functions of athletics would be integrated into the university structure so that the coaches would be part of student affairs. The compliance program would be part of the legal legal counsel's office, which eliminates any conflicts of interest. You'd have the trainers part of the health service. You would have academic advising, where it is an academic should be an academic advising. You would have all of these different functions, development in the development office, so that essentially it would become a seamless structure with the university.
It wouldn't look like Penn State, in other words.
No,
single out Penn State. But what we found from the Jerry Sandusky scandal was this autonomously operating athletic department and football program within it, just doing its own thing on the college campus.
Yeah, and that was, it's obviously in many ways it's a very sad case.
Yeah.
Joe Paterno is much revered for a lot of reasons, but he, because of his success and his longevity, a culture of what I call a culture of reverence developed there, so that even the president, according to the reports I had read, even the president was not willing to challenge him. Even when he had those down years in the early 2000s, the story was that the president went to Joe Paterno and said, you know, isn't it time to retire, Joe? And he said no, and he didn't. I mean, till the end, he was still coaching. And that is the kind of culture where you can have a Jerry Sandusky case happen.
And in your model, there's no guarantee that wouldn't happen. It's just that you wouldn't have this separate, distinct, autonomous culture of sports on the campus.
Well,
it would be more integrated with the college.
Yeah, now, this would not happen in the new NCAA, and that's most sports. But what happens to the big-time sports programs? They would become semi-autonomous corporate entities. There's a nice model of this that John Lombardi wrote about several months ago. And he has some experience with big-time sports. He was the president at Florida and the president at LSU. And what he said is, you know, how about using the model of the university hospital, for example, so that these entities would be organizationally distinct, have ties. They still be under the auspices of the university, but they would operate pretty much on their own, and they would be financially self-sufficient. Now, in these programs, I know, and people would start shuddering at the thought, you know.
No, but that's sort of where you are now anyway, aren't you, with these
big-time
athletic programs?
Well, except for the fact, look, if a university program runs up a deficit, it's the university's deficit,
right,
isn't it?
Right, right. That's a big
distinction.
Yeah.
And so what
That's
happens?
What happened in Maryland, right?
Exactly. And so if the program, and we're not talking about entire athletic departments. Remember, we're talking about programs that can afford to pay for
football,
themselves.
Football, basketball.
Men's basketball. Maybe someday women's basketball, but right now it's not paying for itself. Again, that gender equity issue. But
so they would have their own budget, face their own deficits?
Absolutely. And you know what? The athletes would be professionals. They would be acknowledged as employees, which the NCAA is not willing to do yet. They would have the rights of employees. They would get directly compensated from all that revenue. And you say, well, there isn't enough. They'd have to figure out a way, you know, to make it work. And if they didn't make it work, then they fall, the sports fall back into the new NCAA.
I like the idea. It appeals to me. It is a very appealing idea. I just wonder what the psychological impact of that is, knowing that say you're out watching a football game, University of Texas against Arkansas or something, knowing that the players that you see on the field aren't enrolled as students necessarily. I mean, they might be, right?
Well, they would be enrolled as students, but they would not take classes during their primary season of competition. So they would still, otherwise, why have any connection whatsoever?
Okay. All right. So they would be enrolled as students.
Right.
And they may take a little longer to graduate, but they
Absolutely.
Would at least not be trying to go to class while also playing a sport, a major sport.
Right.
Right. Howard Nixon is our guest talking about his book, The Athletic Trap. What do you think of this idea, how college sports corrupted the academy, is the subtitle of Howard Nixon's book. It's published by the Johns Hopkins University Press. Player compensation, an email from Alan. It is a grave mistake to open the door to the same greedy vultures that predominate professional sports. Some sports revenue should go to support all student sports and other school programs, and players should be allowed to utilize the tuition portion of their scholarships in the future when they have time and are mature enough to finish their coursework. That would be fair and valuable compensation. Head coaches' max salary should be no more than the president of the university. For once, we can set aside our obsessive pursuit of wins and profits and allow our universities to excel as beacons of community service and academic achievement. Well, let's go over some of what Alan says. I think he agrees with you in part here.
He does, in part. I mean, I think that for, as I said before, the vast majority of college students are exactly like those amateurs the NCAA talks about who are involved in the university in similar ways as other students. So I have to say, even though when you're playing in a maybe a Division III program, sports can still be consuming, but there is much more emphasis on your education, obviously, and there are no shortcuts. In my model, I think I'm realistic enough to accept the fact that big time college sports is not going to go away. So how do you organize college sports for the welfare of the vast majority? In fact, for all college athletes. But, you know, there are the athlete students in the big time realm, right? And relatively few. Treat them as professionals, but give them a chance for an education. Take away some of the pressure of trying to go to class and compete in the same semester. And then for everybody else.
In the new NCAA, everybody else that you're describing right. There, aren't you depriving them of revenue? Of millions of dollars of revenue. Say you wanted to expand sports so that more students could play sports on college campuses, right?
There's a justification for an athletic fee, because what could happen is that what if every student at a university who is physically, emotionally able competes or participates in some kind of physical activity? A competitive activity. It could be club, it could be recreational, but there are some schools, some of the small colleges actually require that. That would be a much better use of resources.
So then you could justify a fee.
Absolutely.
It's like paying a tax
Absolutely.
In order to have this service
provided.
There would
provided, be, right? And there'd be no scholarships for the big-time athletes. They would come out of their pay would come out of the same revenue pool as coaches get paid from,
You're talking about at the upper tier.
Yes.
I'm talking about a down a step, where Towson would end up and UMBC would end up.
And these are, it would be a kind of Division III model where general university funds, general college funds would pay for athletics. And part of the revenue for that would come from mandatory fees, but you would budget it like you budget everything else on campus.
I want to spend a little more time talking about why this is a problem, and then we can come back to your remedy, which I really like the model you're describing, Howard Nixon. Let's go back to what the problem is. Let's talk about your own college, Towson University, for instance. Wasn't that long ago the president of the university had to announce the end of some athletic programs because of budget issues?
Right, and it wasn't the first time within the previous 10 years there had been another big cut of about five or six programs. And there were different various reasons given for the cuts. It came from the athletic department, from the then athletic director, Mike Waddell, and he said, we have a gender equity issue, we have a competitiveness issue, we have a budget issue. And so the way to solve this is to eliminate baseball and men's soccer. And, just to be frank, I did not think it was the best idea. I was on the athletic committee at the time. I thought there were other ways we could go. We could reorganize. This was a great opportunity. I saw it. To reorganize. But what happened, and I didn't think it was really a Title IX issue. Most universities have this issue because there is a disproportionate number of women on campus. I mean, Towson has the same issue, and Towson has a history of trying to accommodate women in sport.
What do you think could have been done there when you say an opportunity to reorganize?
Absolutely. I think that they could have de-escalated the
football and basketball.
Football and basketball. Now, football, remember, it has the biggest budget, the most athletes. And it could have played at a lower level. Now, you say, now that's not really possible. I don't ignore the problem of finding conferences. You can, you know, there are different ways to approach this, but there are ways to spend less. Now, obviously what some schools did, like Hofstra in the same conference, just kind of completely got rid of football.
Well, Towson went the other way, though. Towson decided to grow football and build its brand.
Right.
I remember sitting there in my car at a stoplight listening to a radio report about Towson playing LSU. Last season or the season before?
Yes.
2012?
Right.
So Towson's going to play LSU? Why are they doing that?
Yeah, well, it's the sacrificial lamb.
Made money.
They did make money, and that's how you – but the problem
tell folks how much – money they made. Didn't they not
hundreds
make close,
of thousands of dollars,
almost $1 million for
yeah
doing
but you know they didn't make all that money because they have to transport the team. They took some people with them, and
I understand,
you know,
still.
And this is the problem. I mean, it's like when they made the playoffs last year and had a great run, but it cost them.
Right.
It cost them. So success costs at a big time level, especially. But you know, back to the rationale given for the cutting of those sports. I mean, I think that you got at what was the real rationale, and that is more money was needed for football and basketball to pay coaches. And then, of course, the university was able to get what various numbers are floated around, but the ones that I found in the budget were a $73 million investment in a new arena, which is a beautiful arena. But, you know, I know, spoken like a true academic, but the College of Health Professions, the College of Science and Math have been waiting for a long time for buildings, for renovations, for new buildings. And yet, when sports needed it, it happened.
We're going to take a break here and continue our conversation in a moment with Howard Nixon. This is the first of 2 hours we're devoting today to college athletics. Howard Nixon is a sports sociologist and a professor of sociology emeritus at Towson University, author of this very timely book, The Athletic Trap: How College Sports Corrupted the Academy. You're listening to Midday on WYPR. Dan Rodericks here. We'll take a short break. Before we do it, let me give you the phone numbers if you'd like to join our conversation today. 410-662-8780. Toll-free long distance, 866-661-9309. And the Midday email address for comments that way, midday@wypr.org. And welcome back to Midday. Here in Maryland, athletics at the two largest public universities are financed through several sources. There's income from ticket sales, television, sales of T-shirts, other sports paraphernalia. What else? Contributions from alumni. And something students have been griping about for the 30-some-odd years that I've been here, we mentioned it earlier, mandatory athletic fees at College Park. This year, the athletic fee was over $400. At Towson, I think I mentioned it's about twice that much, $800.
That's right. That's right.
Howard Nixon's with us, professor emeritus of sociology at Towson University and a sports sociologist. I mean, what do you think about that income stream? And when I list those things, when I think about it all, the culture we have in the United States and all that money, this trap that you're talking about, the athletic trap, the title of your book, this is a deep trap. Getting out of this trap, this is challenging for any school,
right.
University of Maryland or Towson.
Yeah, well, I cite in the book this asteroid theory. It comes from it was a term used by Charles Klotfelder, a scholar and economist who wrote about sports, and also this guy Jeff Orleans, who was an Ivy League executive. And it's about these things that seem to come out of nowhere, that totally disrupt things that you're controlling and you have no control over. And, you know, I mean, what are we seeing? We're seeing the O'Bannon suit, this Kessler suit that's coming up soon about the antitrust suit, about the limitations on athletic scholarship amounts. You have congressional hearings in the Commerce Committee. People say, why isn't it the Education Committee? Why is it the Commerce Committee? Because we're talking about interstate commerce. This is big-time college sports.
I was going to mention the O'Bannon suit.
Yes.
I wanted to do that. Before we go on to that, just one last thing about Towson.
Yes.
You're a voice there. You said you were on the athletic commission.
Right.
I know you were the NCAA representative. For
I
a
was.
While,
I
you?
Was the far. I love
so,
the university.
I mean, you have a voice there still. I mean, have you had any influence on all this?
Or? Well, I've tried to say my piece. I think in prior administrations in athletics as the far, I was definitely intimately involved with athletic decisions. But it's hard, and there's a new administration, and they're trying hard. The current president tried to do the best she could in a difficult situation, but she herself ended up being caught in the trap, too.
On the O'Bannon suit, for those who aren't familiar with it, that's what it's called. It's the name O'Bannon comes from a former UCLA basketball player, right?
That's right, right. Okay. Ed O'Bannon, uh-huh.
This was only...
A star.
This right. is only Yeah, this was only a couple weeks ago.
That's
on a,
right.
On a Friday, a ruling that came down on a Friday.
Mm-hmm.
The New York Times lead on this says, in a decision that could drastically reshape the world of college sports. Do you disagree with that characterization?
It's a step. And even I've even read where O'Bannon might even countersue because and challenge the case because the settlement.
Let's explain it. A federal judge ruled that the NCAA's decades-old rules barring payments to college athletes were in violation of antitrust laws. But the judge in that case said that the NCAA, the colleges actually, could put a limit on the amount that they pay players. Right,
right? So they could still be act as a kind of cartel, the term that's thrown around a lot. And they could, they can cap the amount. And I think
it's
the way
$5,000, I think.
Right. And I think it's $5,000 a year. And I think they can defer the payment. But it opens the door. But you know what's happening with this autonomy move in the NCAA is the schools are the biggest of the big time schools are talking about these cost of attendance scholarships to. So they cover the full cost of attendance. There have been some embarrassing moments for the NCAA recently when the MVP of the NCAA champion Connecticut Huskies says, you know, I can't afford to put food on the table all the time, and I'm a full scholarship athlete. And he said he had some sympathy for the athletes at Northwestern that were unionizing. I think that the NCAA began to shudder a little bit.
Here's a quote from Judge Wilkin in that case. She said, the high coaches' salaries and rapidly increasing spending on training facilities at many schools suggest that these schools would, in fact, be able to afford to offer their student athletes a limited share of the licensing revenue generated from their use of the student athletes' own names, images, and likenesses. And in the case of Ed O'Bannon, his image appeared in a video game, right?
That's right. And, of course, he got no compensation. I've said, you know, big-time college sports are commercialized and professional for everyone but the athletes who are the key players in all this.
Our guest is Howard Nixon, his book, The Athletic Trap. We'll go to the phone lines, take a call. This is Aaron in Towson. Aaron, you're on Midday. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks for having me. Dr. Nixon, I'm very, very pleased to hear you on the radio today. I'm a former student of yours, Towson University alumni. I just wanted to express further my frustration. You mentioned earlier about Towson's decision to build a new basketball stadium roughly in the area of $73 million. And I don't understand that if, with the budget concerns that there are, why they would make these decisions to spend so much money when they can't fulfill the obligations they have to other programs and, like you mentioned, other buildings on campus. I know everyone that I have spoken to at Towson University when I went there was extremely upset to hear about the loss of baseball and soccer. I mean, these are things that enjoy going to in an afternoon. You know, it's kind of tightens the Towson community and allows us to interact with each other in a different setting. I've spoken with you at men's soccer games, and it was just a wonderful time. And is there anything that the students can do? I mean, we felt kind of like it was out of our hands, but what can the students do to make sure that those programs are sustained, if anything?
Well, I think thank you for calling, Aaron, and I'm glad that you're still interested in these kinds of issues. I think the first step for students is maybe to stand up against the mandatory fee. Ask why they have to pay it, how they are benefiting. I always ask my students, you know, tell me one way in which a big-time athletic program would enhance the quality of your education. And of course, there's no answer to that. But I think that's and you can talk to. I mean, I think students.
So there's no connection between big-time college football or basketball program and academic excellence.
I mean, there is, but
one
it's
is
not
it,
a direct,
there's
you know,
no
it's
connection.
Not a causal connection. No, there is a correlation, an
other
accidental
funds
correlation.
Don't come to the university to fund other programs from alumni who become generous because they're happy that the team's winning? Or,
yeah, well, the idea is, of course, that you're going to have a big-time team and you're going to get branded as a big-time institution so that more students will apply. Will Towson had no problem with that. We had plenty of applicants. More money will come into the coffers for academic programs, but in fact, people who donate, remember I said before, the people who are big-time fans are not really interested in anything but the sports. So they tend to target their donations to athletics, and that might in fact diminish the amount that goes elsewhere in the university.
Yes. I wanted to ask you this. It seems to me, it's an impression I have, at high school, private high schools and at colleges, that if an alumnus wants to donate lots of money to build a football stadium, the football stadium will be built, or an ice rink, or whatever.
With their name
it is,
on it.
With their name on it.
Absolutely.
Am I correct?
Yes. And in fact, what happens, I cited an example of University of Connecticut, where a very powerful alum said that he was very upset that he wasn't consulted when a new football coach was selected, so that you know, he was going to withdraw this big lump of money that he had committed to the university. Well, you know, then the president had to go to him and apologize. And, you know, and you wonder, this sounds like it's upside down priorities, doesn't it? This is very strange.
I just wanted to ask you about the University of Texas. I mentioned the football program in my introduction here. I did some checking here. University of Texas football team generated $139 million in revenue in 2013, just the football program, and had a sizable profit out of that. But the University of Texas is also internationally respected in some realms, right? In educational
Absolutely.
Research
it's
institution.
Fine institution,
right?
As is the right. University of North Carolina. Just name the major public universities and, you know, the flagships that are very, very prestigious. And you find them involved in big-time college sports. There's a long history, and it's hard to get out of that.
But you're saying it doesn't happen for all the schools, that you can cite some examples.
Right. As I said, there are 20.
University of Maryland is an example.
No, it's a,
not an
University
example.
University of Maryland is a fine academic institution, but it has not been able to pay the bills.
Athletics.
And athletics, and that's why they moved. It didn't matter that they were a founding member of the ACC. You know, the thing about this golden triangle that you mentioned earlier that I use as a kind of...
Yeah, we should tell... You know, the golden triangle is a term a lot of people know from
international drug dealing,
Asian market in
Not the same thing.
Well, what do you call the intercollegiate golden triangle?
The intercollegiate golden triangle is the network of connections between tying together big-time college sports with the big media and the corporate sponsors and licensing manufacturers, licensing firms, all that stuff.
So
they are the source of exposure and money.
Even the construction business, I bet you'd include that.
Absolutely.
They want to build new facilities, right?
Right. I mean, they love it when a university wants to go big time or needs to upgrade the facilities. They make hundreds of millions of dollars in some cases. Now, in the case of the Athletic Arena at Towson, $73 million was spent on that.
So the three pieces of that are alumni?
No, the three pieces of the triangle, sports, which encompasses a lot, big-time sports. Remember,
right.
The most commercialized ones.
The media.
The media. And the corporate sector with the apparel manufacturers, the licensing agreements are in that sector, as well as the corporate sponsors who feed their money into the advertising that pays the bills for the media.
A question for Howard Nixon. Can you speak to schools like Davidson, which competed at very high levels but also managed to maintain excellent academic rates. Isn't part of this the issue that students get recruited into the system as athletes first and students second?
Yes, actually, it's funny you mentioned that because one of my sons graduated from Davidson.
From Davidson?
Yes. And
Davidson is in Ohio?
No.
No? Which one is Davidson?
North Carolina.
North Carolina, sorry.
Near Charlotte.
Oh, sorry.
And it's unusual. It's one of those very small schools, academically elite schools, actually, that has maintained a commitment to big-time basketball. Now, it doesn't compete at the big time in other sports, but, you know, from the days of Fred Hetzel and Lefty Dreisel, it was able to raise its profile in that sport, and it's been able to compete. If you want to compete at a big time level, it's a little cheaper to compete in basketball than in football. Now, they certainly do not compete at the Division I level in football, or at the big time level in football, or in other sports.
And what happens at Division III generally? There are more sports. Colleges at Division III can afford more sports.
Kind of a hybrid model. I mean, there are other Division I sports there, but you know, there are things like track and field. I believe they're at the Division I level, but it's, you know, where the biggest money goes in college sports is football, and they do not compete at the big time level in that sport. Their big time fall sport really has been soccer.
But in division, are you talking about Division III?
No,
I'm talking about Division III generally.
Division III,
as compared to Division I.
Right. I mean, I'm using the example of this hybrid of case because the question was about Davidson. But generally, we're talking about Division III when we're talking about a school like Davidson.
Right.
Schools up in New England.
What I'm wondering about is, do they actually offer more athletics than the Division I schools have been able to?
Yes. In fact, my son had to compete in. In a sport, his freshman year, and he competed in crew. That was it. But their students are generally more involved in intramurals, and of course they're smaller too.
Right.
So we're not talking about as many students.
Chris in Charles Village, my question: are the professional sports leagues culpable for the status quo? For basketball and especially football, college sports are de facto farm systems. In baseball, by contrast, every player must pass through the minor leagues. Even surefire players like the Orioles' Kevin Gausman. Could restrictions on how pro football and pro basketball recruit be a means to bring about reform? The connection between pro sports and college.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. That in effect, college football, big time college football, and basketball, even at the mid major level. Are farm teams. And, you know, there's a lot of controversy about the age of eligibility for the NBA. And so you end up with this one-and-done thing. And some people are saying, let's be honest, why are some of these kids in college? They should go right into the pros.
Howard Nixon, our time is short now, but you're talking about a big cultural change here that would have to come from where? This is a deep trap that you describe in
That's
the
right.
athletic trap.
It has to come from the presidents and the trustees. It's not going to come from the NCAA. It's not going to come from the athletic side of the university. It's not going to come from the boosters.
So where would the pressure come from to change?
The pressure is going to come from asteroids.
Congressional
intervention,
lawsuits.
Judge Wilkins' ruling. It's going to transform college sports. And then, again, you're going to have some sports that are at a very highly commercialized level. They will remain. But the rest of college sports could very well move into this toward a new NCAA that's less commercialized, less expensive, and more has more participation by students.
Our guest in this hour of the show has been Howard Nixon, author of The Athletic Trap, published by Johns Hopkins University Press. He was for many years a professor of sociology at Towson University, now professor emeritus with a specialist in sports. We thank you for being here and getting our show off to a good start this first hour. Howard Nixon, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
We'll take a break, folks, and then we have a second hour of the show devoted to this topic, specifically University of Maryland and its decision to leave the Atlantic Coast Conference and move into the Big Ten Conference starting this fall. So please stay tuned for that. We'll take a break here for lunch, brought to us today by the Bagby Pizza Company, located in the historic Bagby Building near Harbor East. The Bagby Pizza Company offers brick oven, thin crust pizza, gourmet sandwiches. Bagby is open daily from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m.